by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the U of I Office of the Chancellor, supporting the Campus Charitable Fund Drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give and how your donations will help our community is on the web at www.ccfd.uiuc.edu.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon here in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine is Julia Kelman. She holds appointments in the School of Art and Design and the College of Medicine at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She's our guest this afternoon. We're going to talk with her about what she calls expressive arts and the healing power of narrative. Kelman has worked with people with HIV/AIDS in a small pilot program at Carle Hospital, the program sponsored by the University of Illinois and funded by Carle. Julia Kelman has written an article about her experiences with the program for the Journal of Aesthetic Education. It was published in the journal's August edition. The title, HIV, Art, A Journey Toward Healing, One Man's Story. Listeners, I hope you'll join the discussion this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Julia, welcome. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sure. You know, art is an expressive endeavor. So what do you mean when you use the term expressive arts? And would you differentiate that for us from art therapy?
Well, sure. Art therapy is much more of I would call a discipline where art is used as both a diagnostic tool and then as a kind of treatment. In other words, an art therapist will look at the kind of psychological needs, for example, that a patient might have, and then work out an individualized curriculum that would then meet that patient's needs in some way, say to express feelings about an illness or a trauma or something of the sort. Expressive arts are less directive. In the first place, they aren't diagnostic. It's not using art as a diagnostic tool, but it's using art as a way of allowing people to explore their own narratives. So if that makes some sense, it's a way of facilitating people's own self-investigation, self-reflection.
So it's a way of saying, my gosh, here I am right now.
Right.
And then using the arts to continue to say, where am I now? And then some point down the line, where am I now?
Right.
And then again, where am I now?
Right. And also it includes, and this is really critical too, is to say, well, this is how the past has been. Probably one will retell or revisit one's past as they work on the present, including a time of, say, disease or disaster or whatever that they're focusing on at that point. How do you re-envision your past and then include that with the story of your present and then to envision a future. Because very often, particularly if someone has been incredibly ill or has had a very chaotic situation, future has become cloudy to non-existent. One can't imagine it. But in order to live in a comfortable way, in a meaningful way, we have to imagine that somehow, we're going to extend our lives beyond this moment. Mm. And so that's what that's about. I just wanted to correct something.
Sure.
We're not doing a pilot program anymore. We're
four
full bore.
Oh,
that
great.
Was just for 1 year. And so now for the last 4 years, it's been a full-time program. And it's also supported by the HIV/AIDS clinic at Carl. So we have our roots in Carl. We have our roots in the School of Art and Design and then also in psychiatry. So that's how we kind of we're sort of the art program is sort of in between those three points.
Yeah. Now, how did this all begin?
Well, that's a good question. As a matter of fact, I used to work with children with autism doing art making and trying to ask myself, how do these children use art to explain themselves and or make meaning for themselves, maybe is a better way to say it, since a child with autism isn't interested in explaining anything to anybody. How do they use it? Why are those children who are interested in art drawing? Why are they making images? And I'd published a book about art and autism, and my husband chanced to meet the head of the Department of Psychiatry and at the med school and explained to her that I'd just published this book, and she said she'd like to read it. So we gave her a copy, and she read it. And in short order, I got an email asking me if I'd ever worked with people with HIV/AIDS. And, of course, my answer was no, but I'd be happy to do so. It would be very interesting. I'd enjoy doing that. And so that was the beginning of the whole thing. I spoke with the HIV/AIDS clinic. They meet as a clinic. The medical staff meets together and the social workers and so on to make decisions about the direction of the clinic and so on and patient issues. And I made a presentation and then they said, yes, this sounded like something they'd be interested in doing. And so it just took off from there. It was just, first of all, you know, the chance of someone reading the book and asking a question.
Mm. And how has it evolved over time?
Well, it started out as a pilot program where I actually just worked with people individually in it was down in the classrooms of the med school, and it was really unsuitable for art making. We were in a computer room, if you can imagine, with carpet on the floor, and, you know, I thought, Lord, if somebody spills something, it's my life. I'll have to cut the section out and, you know, try to patch it so no one will know. But we did that for about a semester just to see how that might work. And then after that, it was decided that we could try to have more people included as opposed to just doing one person at a time. I had about three or four people during that pilot study just to see how that would the whole situation would unfold. And then the class just began that way. And so now it's something that the social workers in the HIV/AIDS clinic and public health tell their clients about. And that's how they get to our art class.
Yeah. How many people have been through the...
About 27 over the years. And people come and go, and there's a small core that have remained over the last 4 years of about maybe about four people, four plus one who kind of is like Pluto. She only appears once in a while. So...
Yeah. Now, what has this experience meant for the people who have taken part in terms of being together and being creative, doing arts together?
Well, the thing that I've found very satisfying about the entire situation is, I mean, one of the things about one's story or one's narrative is that the implication is you're going to share your story with someone. And so to be in a class and working on projects gives people an opportunity to talk about whatever they're doing if they choose to do so. And after an extended period of time, some of us have been together, it must be 4 years by now, it's become like a family, so that we know what kinds of snacks we each like. We know how we drink our coffee. We know what we prefer as far as art making is concerned. I know what students' real skills are, and they're aware of it in one another as well. So it's much more familial.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you're diagnosed with a serious illness, or when you've experienced some trauma at the outset, you feel so all alone.
Yes.
And so here's an opportunity for someone coming into a group who is going to connect, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when two of the people who are probably the two of the longest lived members came, they were in that condition of just being lonely and trying to put a life together. And one person was very depressed. And what the class provided for them, I always sort of imagine it as being either like a branch on a tree. It gives you a place to sit while you pull yourself together. Or another image I have of it, it's like a bridge, and you can kind of sit and rest and then go over the bridge into a new way of thinking about yourself, a kind of a transition into a life as somebody who has agency, as somebody who makes and creates, as someone who is not seen as ill, because that's not part of why we're there. It's all about art making and we do stuff like field trips and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. In the article that you wrote for the journal, you quote an art educator, Marilyn...
Zermulin.
Zermulin. And she says in this book that she wrote, Studio Art, Praxis, Symbol, Presence, she explains, you write, that art class is a place where energy can be realized in action.
Exactly. Just precisely that. And most people don't necessarily have that possibility unless, particularly when they're coming out of an illness, a situation where they've been ill, like, there's no place to focus yourself. One is very frequently in a state of chaos. So it gives you a way of focusing.
It also, that idea of energy being realized in action also says to me it's got to be a release.
Oh, it is. It is. Absolutely. It in many ways. I mean, it makes me think of something that's not necessarily in that particular article, but just recently someone had some very bad health news. And their response then was to do an enormous drawing and write text around the outside of it. And then to juxtapose that huge, it was a self-portrait, that self-portrait with an image of himself years earlier. And then with the reliquary memorializing his experience earlier than that when he first met a particular person and so on. So it gave that person most clearly in that way. It was just a perfect example of exactly that, of using the energy and kind of fear and chaotic sensations as a way, and having a way of focusing it, which was to see it in a way of making art, of making an image, and then pulling together, just as I said, the story of his life, looking at the pieces from the past, but also that had meanings about the past.
Yeah. And this is the individual in the article you write about whose name, you call him Joe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Great guy. And at the outset, he gets the diagnosis. And, of course, like anybody getting a diagnosis, you try and learn more about
right,
what
exactly.
It is. And he just felt overwhelmed, and he took that stuff and threw it.
Exactly.
But at the same time, there was this life-affirming these life-affirming words right. that came to him at the same moment.
Exactly. And he used them in our class to make a very, very beautiful pencil drawing, using the words almost as labels under portions of the image. And so in a way, it works. I see it as working almost, like a mandala, a meditative object, a visual prayer. And, it's a very lovely drawing, and it is very life-affirming. Mm.
Now, Joe is an artist.
Yes.
That helps.
That's true. That's true. But there are people in the class who are not as skilled as Joe, and they get from the situation that which they need, so to speak. One man is, he's there, I think, mainly for the company and doing things, and he loves to take things home, and he's proud of what he does, and he enjoys being with the folks there. And so that's the most important part for him. And then for the other one of the other people, he's just a remarkable guy. He's just so excited about figuring out systems and mathematical relationships. So it's this very absorbing, almost engineering-like mm-hmm. undertaking. And at the same time, he's very interested in art making. But for him, it's almost like the puzzle, solving the puzzle, solving it mathematically, solving it visually, and so on. And then having, at the end of it, something he's created.
Julia Kelman is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She holds appointments in the School of Art and Design and the College of Medicine at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And she's worked with a number of people with HIV/AIDS in a program at Carl Hospital sponsored by the U of I and Carl now. Or has that changed a little?
No, our funding comes through the Carl Foundation. I look to the Department of Psychiatry as supporting us. Dr. Aronson, Sari Aronson, is one of our greatest supporters. And then the HIV/AIDS clinic, and Dr. Johnson is one of the physicians there. Cindy Getting is the social worker, and those are all people who support us as well. And then, of course, I'm supported in the sense that in the past, we've had some money from the College of Fine and Applied Arts to get the initial supplies. I think it was for the first few months of the program. And then the fact that the art department, gives me its blessing, and I use their paper cutter, and I've that kind of thing. I've borrowed paper and,
Yeah. We're talking with Julia Kelman this afternoon here on the program about what she calls expressive arts and the healing power of narrative. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Julia Kelman has written an article about her experiences with this program for the Journal of Aesthetic Education, published in the August edition, the title HIV Art, A Journey Toward Healing, One Man's Story. Also, she is the author of Autism Art in Children, The Stories We Draw. And that's where I'd like to go next.
Sure.
Because at the outset of that book, you wrote about seeing a video in a college anthropology class. And one scene in the video showed a young boy, a member of New Guinea's Dani people, doing something I suspect most of us have done, drawing a picture in the dirt with a stick.
Right.
Tell us about what he drew and the significance of the drawing for him and the significance of this kind of act for children in general.
Well, it was interesting because the little boy, the video was not concentrating on what the little boy was doing. It was concentrating on the little boy as a character in the video itself. And because I'm interested in art and expressive, visual expressive means, and in children, of course, I was watching what he was doing with his stick. They didn't say a word on the video about it at all. And I thought, what is he doing? And he drew sort of an enormous square or a rectangle first, and then he seemed to be dividing it up. And then he did a little tiny kind of square shape off to one side. I thought, what is that? It looked, at first, it looked like a floor plan. And then I realized, because the child was sitting right next to these gardens that the people have, and they have almost, it's almost like a watchtower in each section of the garden. And so you could sit up there and see what's going on in your garden and make sure that animals don't get into it and so on. That he was doing, essentially drawing a bird's eye view of a garden using a stick in the dirt of the garden itself. And the importance, of course, for him in a way was he was almost repeating that image. That's what's important to people in that culture. That's how they live. That's how families. This is you know, what is important to a family. They each have their little plots, and it's important to be the male who has, in fact, one of these things. So in a way, it was almost like a hologram of what a little boy wanted, dreamed, and needed to have when he grew up. It would be like a little boy in our culture, you know, imagining, drawing a picture of himself. I don't know if he lived on a farm, on a tractor, you know, out in the field. It was exactly that same kind of thing.
Yeah. Imagination and reality coming together.
Absolutely, absolutely. Clearly, the little boy had never, you know, flown over the gardens to see it directly down. And at the same time, clearly, he was making concrete his what is of value in that culture and what perhaps his dreams are for himself in the future.
Yeah. So what would you like to say about the role imagination plays in our well-being?
Well, it seems to me, I was just talking yesterday to a group of medical students, and one of the things that struck me is that it was sort of like a continuum of people's attitudes. One person was willing to countenance the fact that our non-linear lives are important. And one of the other people, a nice young man, is absolutely certain that if you can't prove it by running, you know, the kinds of trials that you do with drugs, that it just simply really doesn't exist and you can't say that it matters. And it was an interesting thing because imagination is part of who we are. It's how we sing about ourselves. It's how we see the world. It's how we imagine what might happen next. It's how we can envision anything. And a good deal of what we do with our minds is not particularly linear. Suzanne Langer, the philosopher, talked about two different kinds of intellect. One was the discursive and one was the non-discursive. And imagination and art making are non-discursive. It means that they're more, four-dimensional as opposed to like a line or a text of text. So it's not just that I have noticed this thing. It's a major portion of who we are. It's mm-hmm. it's how we can envision anything, a story, a way of being, a new world.
Yeah. A couple of years ago, I interviewed a woman by the name of Barbara Feinberg. She's the author of a wonderful book called Welcome to Lizard Motel. And part of the book is a diatribe against some of the books that children are reading that are problem-solving books mm-hmm, that are set mm-hmm. out a crisis. And she's a little down on those. But it's also a memoir about the role of story and imagination in her family with her children. And the book, on the book jacket, says about the book, Welcome to Lizard Motel, it is about the unfolding of childhood, the mysterious time when making things up helps deepen a child's understanding of the world. But that continues.
Yes, it does.
Throughout life. I mean, whether we are making things up, creating things, or we're taking part in imagination and reality and working those things together as a member of an audience.
Right.
Or as a person in an art gallery.
Yes. Reading a book.
Reading a book.
Reading poetry. telling one another stories when we're sitting around campfires. A story has been used forever, I would imagine. I mean, I can't certainly prove that people told stories long before the Common Era, but at the same time, I imagine they did. I imagine people sat around their fires. You know, Homo erectus sat around the fire and made, you know, at least grunting noises or perhaps saying something that somehow reflected on the world in which those early human forms lived. And I mean, it's how you spend time. It's how you teach yourself about being human and teach others about being human. Our social roles are very often given to children or explained to children in stories. I mean, if you look at things like, you know, some of the Grimm's fairy tales and so on, those are very often about, well, how do you live in the world? What's really of value? You know, the witch gets beaten, the prince manages to save the princess. You know, it's all about sustaining action and overcoming evil and, you know, good finally triumphing and, you know, all the things that help us say to ourselves when we're faced with a situation, all right, you know, I'm going to just keep on going. I'll get through this hedge of thorns, you know, and it starts out when you're a very small child hearing a story like that. You know, the prince kept on going through the hedge of thorns or whatever he had to do to get to, you know, it wasn't Snow White. I can't think of the character's name as another young woman who was sound asleep waiting for the prince to come. But they're used to teach, they're used to amuse, individual stories are used for us to explain ourselves to ourselves.
Yeah, it seems to me now, I don't know what I'm talking about here, but it seems to me that it has provided us with this need, the need. That's why we have language, and that's why we have written language and spoken language. We have this need to tell story and to tell about ourselves and
that's
to listen
right.
to one another.
Exactly. I mean, that's what people do when they get together. I mean, I am sure in a funny way, in a probably not such an elegant way, why these stupid phones are so interesting to people. If you walk down the street, no one is looking around anymore. They're all carrying on a conversation. But in a sense, that's about that interaction of humans with one another, telling one another what they're doing or what's going to be happening or, you know, what they think they might want to do or whatever.
Yeah, very interesting. That's an interesting way to look at it.
I've heard women in the grocery store. There they are, leaning into, you know, the display of lunch meat, carrying on complex conversations with someone on a phone. You know, talking about what they've seen, good sales, and what they're going to do next, and what they think they might do that evening. It's, you know, it's staggering. It's absolutely staggering. We're so verbal. That's what we're about. But stories are the thing that we do with one another and with ourselves to learn about ourselves and to learn about the world we live in.
Yeah. In the article, I'm going to go back now to the article that you wrote for the Journal of Aesthetic Education. And you wrote about yourself at the outset
mm-hmm.
and a man named Joe, the artist mm-hmm. that we talked about earlier. And maybe you would talk with us a little bit from in a personal sense, about what narrative and art have meant to you personally, and also perhaps how this program that you do with HIV/AIDS patients, which reminds me of another issue I want to bring up, how that has affected you and
okay.
your outlook.
Okay. Gosh, that's a huge thing. I'll tackle it from the art end of it. Right now, a good deal of the art making I do is on holidays in the summer when I have time, because most of my creative energy goes into writing, and I see myself as much a writer as I am anything else, maybe more so. And so I try very hard to write in a way that I'm telling people the truth of someone else's life. I want it not to be inaccessible, and I want people to be very clear about how things look and feel and mean for that person. So I really pay attention to writing. So that's one of my creative undertakings. But I do, in fact, paint and draw, and I'm looking forward to retiring so I can do more of it. But it allows one to move outside of this particular here and now reality into another space and to have a different kind of connection with it. And that's one of the things I find satisfying. I mean, there are things in the world that we all find beautiful. I find the time when light is fading the most beautiful of all in the evening, and when shadows are very, very long. And there's something about that rather low-key color and the almost grating-like shapes of trees, you know, those parallel lines that trees make if there's a sunlight behind them. It's just such a pleasure to look at it. And then what do I get out of the class? These people have become some of my dearest friends. That's what I get from it.
Yeah. And so you're not afraid of being personally involved in
No, not at all. There. And that was one of the things actually I learned. When I started out, I had a much more researcher's view of how I wanted to be, and you have to maintain a certain distance. And the hospital, I think, intimidated me a little bit at first because everyone has that very much more professional clinical sort of view. And I was talking with Dr. Aronson about it later, and she said, "But you're a teacher. You don't have to do that." And I thought, good. I'm glad I don't have to do that, because by then I'd already thrown up my hands and had, you know, we see each other for dinners, we have coffee together. You know, it's not the usual sort of distant relationship one would have.
Yeah. Now I want to turn to, let's see if I can find it now. I made a note from the article. Here it is. If you take a look at the importance of art making for people who are ill, part of it is to be understood.
Right.
And without that insight, the truly astonishing value of art for people who are ill scarcely can be imagined, and the sense of scale of various responses cannot be grasped. For example, small murmurs of pleasure from a person who is miserable seem to me to generally count for more than the self-same soft exhalations from one who is happy and well.
That's true.
So there's got to be a lot of pleasure for everyone.
Yes.
And you see pleasure, small moments of pleasure, in a very different light.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that comes to my mind particularly right now, and this comes from having spoken with those med students yesterday, I have an image, a beautiful kind of painting that a man did several years ago. In fact, it was the first spring that the course was being offered, I believe. Either that or it was the second autumn. And we were, you know, when he came to class, he was very ill, and so he didn't come to class all the time. And he was always diligent about phoning me and telling me he didn't feel very well, but he'd come next time. And so he was working on this beautiful sort of watercolor image, and we were using tissue paper because he wasn't a proficient art maker to get color on the surface of the paper. You get it wet and the color runs. Mm-hmm. And I had suggested that maybe he'd want to think about most beautiful place, the place he thought was the most beautiful in the whole world. What was that? And he had decided that it was the cornfield next to the house where he lived. It was the most beautiful place in the world. And so he made the sky beautiful purples and blues, and the ground was, and you could see the corn. I mean, he was using yellows and greens, and he was making pattern in this very vertical way. Of course, it was very misty and sort of impressionistic. And then he was going to make some stamps, and we were cutting them out of rubber, and then he was going to use those as a way of sort of elaborating the image. And he'd made a butterfly, and he did a wonderful grasshopper. And he worked and worked and worked. And finally, it was time for class to be over. And, you know, we just had to close things up. And I you know, we put the work away and it was wet. And I said, yes, you can finish it next time. And it gave him such joy, such incredible joy just to be doing that. And the thing, this is going to sound I'm not sure what, but he died before the next class, and so he didn't get to finish it. But I thought, here this man is at the end of his, literally at the end of his life, just days from the time that finally his body gave out, you know, wanting to do this so much, taking such pleasure in it. I mean, it seemed to me that though that was not a momentous thing, it was the most beautiful gift he could have had at that time, an afternoon of just pure pleasure. And so in some cases, art can be doing that. It can be giving you that. Or in the case that we spoke of earlier when Joe had gotten some disappointing health news, though that wasn't pleasurable to make this huge self-portrait, it offered a kind of peace that he didn't have. It was a way of dealing with a difficult situation, of externalizing it and giving it form that otherwise wouldn't have existed. So, you know, it's a kind of release in that case. So that art can work in any one of a number of ways. For one man, he just gets so tickled when he gets done with something. He is so pleased. And he did a wonderful papier-mâché bird, a blackbird with sort of a golden head. And he has it in his apartment, and he's so proud of it. And just the joy of having done that is remarkable. Or the man that's the, you know, more mathematically inclined is so satisfied when he works out one of these incredibly complicated constructions. I mean, and now his house is full of his artwork. And so, you know, at whatever level it's pleasurable or it meets your needs, that's what's important about it. Yeah. But it can meet lots of needs.
Yeah. The thing I said earlier that I wanted to come back to, it was because I said HIV/AIDS patients. And it seems to me that this work, the artwork, is a way to maybe move patient off.
It is off.
Center stage.
It's exactly off center stage.
Put it in the balcony.
That's right. Or if not, out in the parking lot. And in fact, when I write, I never use that word because for me, these people aren't patients. They're students and they're friends. And those are the words that I use. I'm more apt to use student, but I never say patient because when we're together, that's not the interaction.
Right.
They're art makers.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener.
Okay.
Caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I love the topic. You know who I am. Anyway, my question is, I'm a nurse and I'm about 70 years old. Do other species have this imagination? I have not read the book. Now, just listen for your guest on the air. Thank you.
I don't know if other animals have that imagination. But I can tell you, just watching my cats, that they've got something up their sleeve sometimes, pretending to catch a mouse, throwing, you know, a ball in the air, pouncing, practicing all those skills. So I sometimes think they must be sort of saying, now I've got the mousey, I'm flipping it up and down.
And you can see joy. You can see joy,
yes, exactly.
In your companion animals.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Or, you know, foals in a field playing and running up and down. I don't know what's going through their minds, but they're swatting their tails and whinnying and rearing. And there's a joy there, too. So I don't know. I don't know what the images are in their minds, but there's something going on.
Yeah. Well, our ability to connect with them and they with us counts for something,
it
too.
It does. It does. It does, it seems to me.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Julia Kelman is our guest this afternoon. We have a few minutes remaining in this portion of the program. So if you'd like to join the conversation, feel free. We'd love to hear from you. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We're talking this afternoon about what Julia Kelman calls expressive arts and the healing power of narrative. Now, there's an interesting thing to talk about, the idea of healing. What does it mean? Journey toward healing.
I see. Early on, I came to understand that there are two ways to think about things. There's curing, which means making a disease go away or having a broken bone knit and putting back together in that way. But healing has to do with putting back together in an emotional and mental way. And you can be healed but not cured. And probably the most important part of medicine for people, say, who have catastrophic illnesses or who may be at the ends of their lives, for example, or who are really undergoing a difficult time, is healing. I mean, curing is going to be maybe off the board for them, but that you can feel part as yourself as being part of life. You can feel yourself as being having a rich and rewarding life, even though that there perhaps is an end coming closer to you than to other people at that time. So it doesn't mean you've gotten over it, whatever it is. It means that you're at a point of balance and serenity personally, which is actually how I kind of see what healing is. It's balance, serenity. A sense of beauty. It's almost like the Navajo blessing way chants, thinking about beauty as balance.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I almost called a couple of minutes ago when you were leading up to that AIDS patient thing, and then you just discussed it the way I wanted to hear you talk about it. And then as I was mulling that over, another term I've heard is AIDS victim, and
I don't use it.
Well, I haven't heard you use it. I have heard it used, and
I don't think it's suitable.
Yeah, I don't either. And
it's.
I'm not proposing that. I think that's another one and I've known a number of people and worked with people with HIV. And that's not a term that they like.
Not at all.
And you know, a person with AIDS is kind of cumbersome. I'm just wondering if you have a term or something if you're not using, and I don't like the patient either. It's too medical, and you're not dealing with medical things.
Right. Well, I don't know. I get to duck out of it because I'm an art teacher, and I can call them art makers, and I can call them students. And so that's the way I talk about people in my art class. And if I'm talking about a medical situation, then I would say a person with AIDS, and it puts the person first.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's cumbersome, but I can't think of anything else. If you can, I'd love to know.
Well, and I'm just curious if you'd heard other people, like the people you'd worked with, you know, refer to themselves in some way or another that they more comfortable with. I'm just curious if there was something.
There are some slang words, the PAWS. Yeah. Which means positive, HIV positive. So people will say that, but I don't necessarily use that word either. As I said, I just can dodge out and say students.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm,
thanks
sure.
for the call. I think that, you know, when we introduce ourselves to one another, you know, it's interesting where we start, and generally it's not going to be patient.
No. Where's that? A horrible word.
Even if I'm on my way to the doctor or
right.
sitting in the doctor's office, I'm not going to say, hi, my name is Celeste Quinn. I'm a patient.
No, of course not. And even if you're really ill, that's not what you're thinking to yourself. You're always yourself. I mean, you're thinking of yourself as your own being, you know, and you're not focusing on that, you know, sort of odd category.
Yeah. Now, this program is for persons who've been diagnosed with HIV or AIDS and or AIDS, but it seems to me that this kind of thing could be of benefit to so many people.
Well, it could, and I would so, and I hope everybody at Carl is listening to this. I would so love to start in our program at Carl, but they have like every place on the planet economic constraints, and then they have plans that. You know, that they as a group put together that sort of chart what they do. And right now, you know, I'm simply, I've proposed that we think about art in a more expanded way. Other hospitals have art programs. University of Iowa Hospital has a huge art program. They have visiting artists that go to patients' rooms with people who are actually staying in the hospital. You can check out as a person staying in the hospital art making materials. They have an art gallery. And what I'd like to see at Carle is one permanent area that we could have art from people in my art group and other art groups displayed on a regular basis. Yeah. You know, just a glass-fronted case that we could put it in so it'd be safe. And then I would like to see people think about expanding the program to PEDS, for example, and to making things like art supplies available to patients in the hospital. Those are easy to do things. We'd need a closet, we'd need the money to buy the materials, and we would need somebody to organize it. And I can just organize like crazy. So,
And then you wouldn't have to look at the TV.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much.
Julia Kelman has been my guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She holds appointments in the School of Art and Design and the College of Medicine at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade again, a very quiet trade today at the board. That despite another huge number for the corn that came out from Informa this morning. As you probably recall, earlier in the week, FC Stone releasing a 10.9 billion bushel corn crop and a 3.1 billion bushel soybean crop projection. Informa today, that's the old Sparks Group, releasing their number. Their corn number was bigger than FC Stone's at 10.97 billion bushels, with an average of 147.6 to the acre across the nation. A little bit smaller on the soybean, still a 3 billion bushel even crop there, 41.6 bushels to the acre, Informa says, for the national average. We'll talk with Dan Zwicker during the closing market report this afternoon about that. Kind of a special closing market report, too, today. We're going to take just a little extra time. At noon today, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Mike Johann spoke to the Commodity Club luncheon in Washington, D.C. at the Washington Hotel, made a fairly important policy speech, and while he did not outline what the Bush administration's policy for the next farm bill will be, he did outline some of the things that are likely to go, at least in the Bush administration's mind. Those probably include all those direct and countercyclical payments and program payments that we talked to you about yesterday at the front of the program, or at least they're looking at changing them. We're going to run the whole 27 minutes during the closing market report. You better shut the combine down and listen to this one, because it's going to be important to your back pocket by the time 2008 rolls around. Now let's take a look at the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade. December wheat, 346.5, the high, the low at 340.5. Settlement price at 345.25. They were up a quarter for the day. The March futures, 360.5, the high, the low at 354.5. Settlement price, 359.25, unchanged. And the May at 367 high, low at 361.5, settled 366.5. They were unchanged as well. July futures, 372.5, the high, the low at 367. Settlement price, 371.5, unchanged. September futures, 377.5, the high, the low at 373. Settlement price, $3.77, unchanged for the soft red winter wheat September contract at the Board of Trade. December corn futures, 205.5, the high, the low at 203.75. Settlement price, 204.25. They were down 0.5. The March contract at 218.25 high, low at 216.5. Settlement price at $2.17. They were down 0.75. May's corn, 226 the high, the low at 224.25. Settlement price, 225, off 0.5. And July futures at 233.25 high. The low there, 231.5, settlement at $2.32. They were off 0.5. September futures, 239.5, the high, the low at 238.75. Settlement price at 238.75, down 1. In the December contract, 248.75, the high, the low at 247.75. Settlement price at 248. They were off 0.75. December oats, a 169.75 high, low at 167.25, settlement price at $1.68.75, up 0.5, and the March contract up 0.75 at $1.73 for the final price for the day. November soybeans now, $5.74 the high, the low at 559.5, settlement at 564.25. They were up 0.75. January's penny and a half higher, 584 and three quarters the high, the low at 571. Settlement price at 576 and a half. They were up 1.5. The March futures in the bean pit, 593 the high, the low at 580. Settlement price at 583 and a half, up three quarters. In the May contract, a 597 high, low at $5.84. Settlement price at 588 and a half. They finished a quarter higher. July soybeans up 1.25, 593 and a quarter settlement price there. 602 and a half the high, the low at 589 and a half. And the August contract had a $6 even high, the low at 590. Settled on that low. They were still up a penny for the day. October bean meal, 165.30 the high, the low at 162.60. The settlement price at 163.70. They were up 90 cents. And December bean meal up $1.20 at 167.30. Bean oil futures, the high today, 24.22 in the October contract, low at 23.52, settled at 23.82, down at 3, and December bean oil had a high of 24.50, a low at 23.72, settlement price there at $24.04, and they were off 12 cents. Celeste Quinn's here now with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Celeste, thanks much for opening some space up during the closing market report. We'll pick up a few extra minutes because you allow us to, so we can run this policy session that the Secretary of Ag had at the noon hour today.
Well, sounds like it's important, so let's get that information out there to
Yes, indeed.
Listeners.
Thank you much. What did Merc look like today?
Well, feeder cattle finished higher. Live cattle finished lower. Lean hogs were lower, but bellies finished higher today. October feeder cattle, the high 117.90, the high. The low 117.10, the settlement 117.57.5, that up 47.5. November 116.75, the high 115.80, the low. The settlement 116.27.5, that up 40. January 113.80, the high 113.10, the low. The settlement 113.32.5, that up 12.5. October live cattle 90.55, the high 89.55, the low 89.72.5, the settlement that down 57.5. December live cattle 91.45, the high 90.55, the low, the settlement 90.77.5. So December live cattle finished down 27.5. October lean hog 67.95, the high 67.20, the low 67.67.5, the settlement that down 52.5. December 65.02.5, the high, the low 64.10, the settlement 64.37.5, that down 95. February 67.40, the high, the low 66.70, the settlement 67.15, that down 62.5. And April lean hogs 66.50, the high 65.70, the low, the settlement 66.27.5, that down 70. And February bellies finished up 2.5 cents today. The high 98.35, the low 96 even, the settlement 96.40. Again, that up 2.5. The Dow's off 40 points at 10,277. The Nasdaq down 18 at 20.85. The S&P 500 7 lower at 11.90.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including